This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Daniel Schachter is a memory researcher who's using state-of-the-art imaging techniques to learn how the brain stores and retrieves memories. He's also learned about memory by studying amnesiacs, stroke victims, and others with memory disorders. Schachter co-founded the Unit for Memory Disorders at the University of Toronto. He's now a professor of psychology at Harvard. He's the author of the new book, Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past. I asked him if he could describe what happens in the brain when a memory is stored, if there's a physical change in the brain.
There is something physical. There are changes in the brain that reflect the memory, and many people believe that this is based on changes in the patterns of connections among neurons in the brain. But one fascinating insight that we've had in memory research over the last number of years is that there isn't any one place that the memory is stored. There's nowhere that you could go in and poke around and stimulate and say, aha, I found the memory, there it is, it's in that cell, or it's in that little group of cells. Rather, the view that many of us subscribe to is that different parts of the brain analyze different aspects of experience. Maybe there are parts of the brain devoted to analyzing visual experience, others to auditory experience, others that react to emotional aspects of experience. And these different parts of the brain seem to hold in their different respective areas the relevant attributes that relate to how they operate. So, for example, visual areas of the brain probably hold on to the visual aspects of an experience. Auditory areas of the brain probably hold on to the auditory aspects of experience. So the memory is kind of distributed among a wide set of brain structures that were involved in encoding the experience in the first place. And many people believe that these structures in the inner parts of the temporal lobes that I referred to earlier help tie together or hold together or link or bind these different areas that were involved in encoding the experience in the first place. So the memory is kind of all over the place, to speak about it informally.
And now, when we want to retrieve memories, is this why sometimes, like, a smell will bring back a flood of memories? Because the smell part not only gets a smell memory, but it triggers off the other interconnected parts of the larger memory?
Yeah, exactly. One of the interesting things about retrieval cues is that they, for them to work, they have to have been things that were salient when you initially encoded an experience. There are lots of experiments that show this. It's one of the fundamental principles of the psychology of memory that it's not just any old cue will do, but it's got to be a cue that reminds you of something you think or felt at the time of the original experience. I was on a visit to San Diego a couple of years ago with my family, and having been there many times, I wanted to do something novel. So we decided to go out to visit the Coronado Hotel. Having never been there before. We drove out. My wife read a description of it to me. We got to the hotel, and it's a magnificent, beautiful example of Victorian architecture. We walked through the lobby and walked into a little courtyard, and all of a sudden I remembered, my God, I've stayed at this hotel. I was here for a conference 4 years ago. Why didn't I remember it until I walked right into that courtyard? Well, that was a trip that took place just before I made a move to Harvard University, where I'm now a professor. And I had kind of encoded that trip to myself as the trip before Harvard. And out in that courtyard, lots of people were asking me about how my move was going, because I was about to move in a week, and all the conversation centered around that. So that courtyard was kind of a cue that reinstated how I initially thought about that trip. Whereas other features of the experience, like what the hotel looked like and so forth, were not as salient. So it's a fundamental point about retrieval cues, is they've got to reinstate how you thought about or how you reacted to an experience in order to be effective.
People who drive with me won't want to hear this, but sometimes, like, I'm on the expressway and I say to myself, gee, I don't remember entering the expressway, but here I am on it. That's a disturbing thought to have. But, often I'm like listening to a tape and, or I'm, deep into a song I'm listening to. on a CD or a tape when I'm in the car. And this is a kind of scary thing when you don't remember how you got to where you are.
It is a scary thing, and I would have to admit that it's happened to me more than once in my life, and I'm sure it's happened to most of us. But it reflects something really important about memory, which is that, again, memory is not a video recorder just simply taking pictures of the world out there. And the kind of situation you're referring to is one in which we're wrapped up focusing on internal thoughts, preoccupations, and we're not paying attention to the external environment.
Is there a memory muscle that you can exercise and strengthen, thereby strengthening your ability to remember anything?
No. That, again, you've hit on one of the persisting myths of memory, and it turns up in a number of different guises. But let me give you a couple of examples that illustrate why I say no, and no pretty firmly on that one. A number of years ago, some psychologists at Carnegie Mellon University wanted to examine that kind of question. If you just brought someone into the lab and had them practice remembering information over and over again, would it be possible to strengthen the memory muscle so that they would just have a better memory for everything they encountered? Brought in a couple of college students, had them try to remember digit strings. People usually can only remember 7 digits from immediate presentation. Had them do lists of digits over and over again. After 2 weeks, there was little improvement in either of them. One of them quit. However, one student stayed with the practice. And after a couple more weeks, started recalling more than 7 digits at once. He got up to 20. He got up to 30. Several months of practice, he got up to 50, he got up to 70, he got up to 80. I mean, I give you a string of 80 random digits and you give it back to me in order. You might think, well, maybe the memory muscle did improve, it just took a lot of practice. But in fact, that's not what was going on. This student had hit upon an encoding strategy a couple of weeks into practice of bringing to bear his previous knowledge and memory on this current new information he had to remember. He was a track runner for the Carnegie Mellon track team, and he figured out a scheme for making that information available so he could make these digits meaningful. So if he saw a string like 4125, he'd think, oh, that would be a pretty good time for me running a mile on a windy day, and built from there some very elaborate strategies. So that at the time that he could use these strategies to remember 80 digits at once, when he was given a test for letters, he could still remember 7. His memory muscle hadn't improved. He managed to find his way to this fundamental insight that memory for new information depends critically on using what you already got in memory.
Mm-hmm. So I guess your best advice on how to remember something is to focus on it. Don't be distracted and dividing your attention between this and something else at the same time. And also try to have some kind of meaningful associations.
It's the meaningful associations that are critical. Analyzing incoming information deeply. There's a study I quote in the book that I particularly like that looked at how actors memorize their lines. Mm-hmm. And you might think they do all kinds of brute force memorization and rack their brains, repeating lines over and over. Doesn't seem to be that way. What they do is they search for clues to their characters in the lines. So they're carefully analyzing everything their character says, and the result of that detailed, careful analysis is an excellent memory for exactly what the character said, because the subtle nuances of what the character said that the actor is analyzing then are retained in memory as a result of that kind of an encoding process. So to the extent that we can do that, thoughtfully, extensively, and elaboratively, and now analyze the world around us, we will an automatic benefit will be good memory for that information.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's an expert on memory. He studied a lot of patients who have had brain dysfunctions and brain injuries. His new book is called Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychologist Daniel Schachter, author of the new book, Searching for Memory. Since memory is so subjective and also so unreliable, do you think most of us live in delusions about who we really are and what we've really done and lived through? I mean, if I told you the story of my life, would I probably be filling that story with distortions?
Yes and no. I think that distortion in memory, as I discuss in the book, tends to occur at the level of remembering particular experiences. There's a fascinating aspect of memory that we call source memory, remembering exactly when and where something occurred. And this is an important source of memory distortion. For example, one dramatic story I tell in the book is of a psychologist who was accused of rape on the basis of a very accurate eyewitness identification. It turned out, however, that he had an airtight alibi. He was on television talking, ironically, about memory at the moment when the woman who was raped was raped. And the reason he was accused is that under stress, the woman had remembered his face. She was watching this very show, but forgotten the context from which she derived this information. It wasn't the rapist. It was the television. So when you can the failures of source memory, remembering exactly when and where some bit of information came from, turn out to have enormous implications for understanding a memory distortion that I talk about in the book with respect to childhood testimony, brain damage, aging. However, when we talk about memory for the broad contours of our past, the general outlines of our past, the kinds of things that have happened to us repeatedly, I would say we're basically pretty good. Studies have shown, for example, that family members generally have the same kinds of memories at the general level, of the general features of their childhood. So there's some distortion always around the edges, but the most serious kinds of distortions in memory usually occur at the level of individual episodes.
What are you looking at now in your research?
Doing a number of things. We're very excited about some recent work we've done on brain scanning, where we found that it's possible to distinguish between true and false memories using PET scans. And we found some interesting similarities between true and false memories using these PET scans. And we think that this is some work that is described in the book when I talk about memory distortion. So we're following up on that. We're trying right now to get a good picture of what's going on in the brain during true and false memory. Because although psychologists have known about memory distortion for many years, it's only very recently now that people who are interested in the brain bases of memory have started to look at this important issue. So we're doing a lot of that.
Let me stop you there for a second. What is a false memory, and how can you tell with the research that you're doing? How does it register differently in the PET scan?
In the particular study I'm talking about, we induced a quote-unquote false memory by having people listen to a series of words that are all thematically related to one another. For example, I would say to you, candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, nice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, eat, pie. And what you will find is that if you test someone's memory a few minutes later after having heard those words, if I ask you, for example, did I say the word taste, do you remember?
I think so. Couldn't swear to it.
Couldn't swear to it, but you think so. How about the word point?
I don't think so.
You don't think so. How about the word sweet?
I think so.
Didn't say sweet.
Okay.
That's your false memory.
Right.
The reason why you thought so for sweet is that it's thematically related to all the words I did say, candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, and so on. And what psychologists have found initially a number of years ago, a psychologist named Deese found out that people who heard this list would often produce the word sweet, even though it was never produced. And a couple of colleagues of mine, Roddy Roediger and Kathleen McDermott, recently found that people will, like you just did, will false alarm to sweet and claim with great conviction that it was on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we looked at memory for words like sweet during PET scans that had been preceded by a bunch of associates, but had not been presented, which people felt that they remembered. And we compared that to PET scans, for example, for words such as taste, which had been previously presented. And what we found, one interesting similarity between the two, is that we found some signs of activity in the inner medial or medial regions of the temporal lobe that we know are important for memory, for both the true and the false memory. On the other hand, we found that there was a part of the brain in the left hemisphere that has been previously implicated in memory for sound or phonological properties of words that was active for the true memory but not for the false memory, and significantly more so for the true than the false. So this is what allowed us to distinguish between the two. And I talk about some of this at length in the book, and we're now following up on this, and we think this is an interesting kind of first glimpse into some of the brain systems that are relevant to accurate and distorted memory. And in our research program now, we're investigating this, because one of the things that fascinates me is what I call in the book, it's kind of the driving theme of the book, what I call the fragile power of memory. Why is it that memory can, as in this little example here, be distorted, sometimes ephemeral, yet at the same time it has such great power in our lives, and we can have great conviction sometimes about memories that are wrong? And what I'm really interested in doing is figuring out some of the brain bases of this fragile power of memory that I talk about in the book.
Boy, you know, somebody might want to do a very high-tech lie detector test based on the research that you're doing. How would you feel about that?
Well, you know, this question often comes up, and I don't think that this could be used in that way for a number of reasons. Number one, the particular brain area that we found that activated more for true than false memory probably would move around depending on exactly how you did the task.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in our PET experiment, people heard the words at the time of study, just like I read them to you. And that's why we think the auditory area activated more for true than false memory. My guess is you'd get a different area activated if people saw the words, for example, at the time of study. But so it's not that there's one area that would function as a lie detection area. Second, these PET scan experiments depend on a whole series of comparisons among experimental conditions. They're fairly complex, and it would be way overly simplistic to think you could hook someone up and just get a readout on whether the memory is true or false. This study doesn't say that we can do anything like that.
And what you were saying about whether the memory was more of a verbal memory or a taste memory, it would register in a different part of the brain. That gets back to what you were saying before about the different systems of memory that we have. It's not all in one place. It's not all one thing.
That's exactly right. And once you have that insight, then you start to think about memory in a very different way. You start to think about what experiments you're going to do in quite a different way. So rather than thinking that we had activated a true memory center or anything of that sort, we think that what happened is we got some activation for an aspect of memory that was relevant to the particular task, and now we want to try to see if we can move that around in future studies.
I have one last question for you. What's your favorite amnesia movie? It's a whole genre, the amnesia film.
That's right, and there are quite a few of them. I got to come down on the side of the old classic, Spellbound. I don't think it ever got any better than that.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Schachter is the author of the new book, Searching for Memory, published by Basic Books. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard. This is Fresh Air.